podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.
Hello all, welcome to another episode of Armchair Cricket Podcast, a podcast focusing on test cricket by armchair critics of the game. I'm your host, Ajit. In today's episode, we are looking forward to the finals of the Cricket World Cup after, 10 years of matches or whatever. So to help me unpack that, we have a friend of the show, someone we know very well from the Guerrilla Verse, Messi. Hello, Messi Jess. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ash. It's lovely to be here. It's strange having a day with no international cricket to watch, so it's nice to be able to speak with you.
Absolutely. Apparently, we won't leave it alone. We'll still want to talk about it, even on our days off, isn't it?
Indeed, indeed. Although I'm pleased to say that there's plenty of Sheffield Shield cricket and women's Big Bash cricket to keep me going in the off time.
I'm a big fan of Sheffield cricket as well. I mean, just that I'm not yet able to catch up. There's enough other things going on, but I will switch.
I know the feeling.
So for me, you know, the Cricket Australia app, they offer live radio commentary of the ongoing games. So it's a good way to, you know, start early on in the day if you're in Europe and just keep company with some cricket in your ear. So
indeed.
Now, coming back to the main matter at hand, did you catch? I think you did. I heard you on air on both the semifinals.
I did indeed. I think there's only six games throughout the whole World Cup that I haven't been on air for. So, I've seen a lot of cricket over the last 6 or 7 weeks. And yes, I did watch them and I actually enjoyed them both very much.
Perfect. So let's start with the first of the two semifinals. I mean, India winning the toss and sort of a perfect template if you're an India fan.
Absolutely. I mean, once India won the toss, it was no coincidence that the odds against New Zealand winning suddenly went out a very long way. To be honest, I think the way that Rohit started, there was an expectation that it would be so far beyond New Zealand that it would become very dull, but it didn't. Hmm. And I really enjoyed the game. I thought in the circumstances where that loss of the toss was huge, New Zealand did an extraordinary job to get as close as they did. Yeah, you know, a few breaks their way, and it could have been much closer than it was.
Indeed. So, if we start off with the India innings, first of all, the way Rohit and Shubman started, indeed. Rohit was out in the ninth over, score was already 71. They had the platform in place, sort of what you want in a big game. No shakiness right at the top. You know, India have occasionally had these glitches right at the top where they've lost one or two wickets inside the first 5-8 overs and then scrabbled to try and recover. Nothing doing of any sort like that here. That's one thing. But then, well, Kohli comes in form, builds on that with Gill. And by the time Gill has retired hurt, well, at least they have made it in such a way that 164 is the score when Gill retires hurt. So again, it's a very comfortable place from which the rest of the Indian batting order can dominate, which they did duly.
Indeed. I think it was actually very, very, it was perfect spot for Gill to actually take a break anyhow. because it was warm enough and he was knackered. I mean, I can't remember how many he was on at the time, probably in his 60s.
79 or something, I think.
That much, right. And it was, you know, he wasn't scoring particularly fast at the time. I think he was feeling the heat. Yeah. And the fact that he wasn't seriously injured was just perfect to have a break, let somebody else come in. And if he needed to come in later, which he did. So it worked out very nicely for him. I mean, it's not that he and Kohli hadn't done, and Sharma hadn't done the work to get to a stage of that being possible. But it couldn't have worked out much better for them, I don't think.
Well, at least the one thing he would be disappointed is not carrying on to his 100, because he had 100 for the taking. He was slowing down. You're right. He was scoring comfortably at 130 strike rate. And by the time he retired, he was 120 and dropping. So he was feeling the conditions. But Kohli simply carried on. And Shreyas Iyer joined him and they then put the pedal to the metal, as they say. And then, well, no looking back until Kohli was dismissed in the 44th over, having made yet another 100, the 50th. Kamath the big man.
Indeed. I mean, there is something just so imposing about Kohli. And he played some beautiful shots. There's a little bit of me that says that because of the occasion, maybe India could have got 20 or 30 more runs if Rohit hadn't been conscious about coming towards... Virat hadn't been conscious about coming towards his century. Because through the late 80s and the 90s, he was relatively cautious. And then once he got to his 100, he started hitting out. And he got out, and that was fine. The other thing that occurred to me is, it may sound an odd comparison, but I do see some similarities between Virat Kohli and Stephen Smith in the first innings of a match, in that he is very much the anchor around which others can take liberties. And it worked very, very well for India in these circumstances. He's a different animal in the chase because he's not so much an anchor. He's the tiger that's going after it with a very conscious idea of the rate that's needed. But this one was about giving other people a license while he continued to score at a decent rate, I thought.
Absolutely. I mean, he was the anchor. He was the ballast so that people like Shreyas, Rahul could express themselves, which they did. Another wonderful 100 for Shreyas. Just, 60-odd
that
balls.
That was a superb 100. And I think, in a way, underappreciated because all the eyes were on Kohli. But it was wonderful to watch. I mean, the fact that he hit 8 sixes in that was quite extraordinary.
Absolutely.
And on any other day, it would have been man of the match material. I don't think there's much doubt.
No, absolutely.
It was superb.
That 100 gave the impetus. So India were also at some point in time. Really, 350 was never in doubt. But then the thing that pushed India closer to 400 was that knock by Iyer. He got his own 100 back-to-back 100s again, sort of putting to bed any sort of doubts about his suitability or his hunger for the top occasion. But of course, Rahul followed with a almost flawless what sort of a knock you would want. Surya failed, and then I don't know why they actually sent Gill out for a ball or two. But that's okay. Maybe they thought, with 5 balls left, he can really, if he has it in him to hit 5 big shots, why not go for 100? I mean, that would have been too much.
Yeah.
That didn't happen. But Rahul finished very consummately. So 397, batting first. Saudi, unfortunately, got 100 of his own. Between him and Trent Bolt, they were a bit costly towards the end. Lockie Ferguson is never preferred, right, to bowl out.
Yeah.
That's a problem. I mean,
the New Zealand bowling was much less disciplined than it often has been in this tournament. And I think that was very costly to the Māori. I mean, obviously, they were facing an onslaught from Sharma in particular at the beginning. But I don't think they reacted to it particularly well. They didn't keep their lines all that well. And it was unusual for Bolt and Sarthi to be as expensive as they were.
Yes. I mean, one of the highlights was how Sharma took on Bolt right at the start, because Bolt is usually the danger man. With the new ball, he tends to do some damage right at the start. But Sharma ensured that was not going to be the case, right? So anyway, after having blunted them, I see the only thing I had a point, if anything, if you're not going to bowl Chapman, why not have Nisham in the 11? I know Chapman is a very consummate batter. He has a lot of backing from the management, but I thought Nisham's finishing skills with the ball could have been handy.
I think that's exactly right. I think that was a missed trick for New Zealand. And, Nisham can bash it around a bit when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that New Zealand's tail, they were set an impossible task in the end, but there was no fight left at all, which I would have expected at least from Jimmy Nisham to hit out a bit with some success.
Right. I mean, that's meant to happen. If you were to look at the New Zealand chase, Conway and Ravindra, very crucial, both of them. One of them needed to go on, right? Conway had faded a little bit. Yeah.
Yes, I think both of them have tailed off a little bit towards the end of the tournament in terms of their batting.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that you just got to give credit to the Indian opening spell, particularly Bumrah. It was just unplayable. And the scoreboard pressure was on from the start, chasing 400. And the truth is that Ravindra was all at sea. When he got out, he was playing, you know, a good 2 or 3 feet from his body. He wasn't moving his feet at all. Mind you, that's not uncommon in white ball cricket, it has to be said. Mm. But I'd hate to be facing the prospect of Bumrah in that sort of form. I know he only took the one wicket, but I think he was a key to that containment.
No, absolutely. I really
did. And of course, Shami as well.
If you were to think about it, if you were to go one step back, I think Bumrah was not really on point to start off. Conway was looking good. He looked like he could go on, build that sort of, you know, the anchor in a huge chase. But then it fell on Kane Williamson because both the openers failed. They couldn't get going. So Kane Williamson took on that job. But they were a bit slow, if you were to think of it, by the 10th, 12th, 13th over, they were still a bit slow. But by the 30th over, what a comeback, where scoring at 7 runs an over, Williamson going at almost on a ball, exactly what you need in that situation, like a Kohli, like knock, right? Daryl Mitchell was the aggressive.
Absolutely, very much, yeah. I agree. I thought Williamson was brilliant for what he does. But when he tried to put his foot down is when he got caught on the boundary, and that's sort of the way it's going to be with someone like Williamson. He is a really, you know, a decent runnable ODI player. But in terms of acceleration, he really does find it tough. And that was a huge flaw, because that wicket of Williamson when it fell was really the start of the end for New Zealand.
I think there was a bit of byplay there where you see the way they celebrated Rohit and Shami, it was a plan. That they set up Williamson, that there was going to be this fielder in the deep that either Williamson did not spot or thought he could hit finer of him, but it went straight to the fielder Surya Kumar Yadav. And that plan came through, and in the same over, Shami took out Latham. I mean, now we have to speak about that spell of Shami, where every time he came to the crease, he took a wicket in the first over. Whenever his captain wanted, he turned to Shami and he comes back. He's dismissed the top five batters. What else can you ask for a strike bowler in
For a guy who wasn't even in the first 11, he's extraordinary in his success. I mean, he's the key to India's win, obviously, at the end of the day, because the penetration just wasn't there for the other bowlers, was it?
Correct. I mean, Jadeja was also a bit pedestrian, strangely. He was collared one big hit every over, and that's thanks to Daryl Mitchell, how Mitchell played. Mitchell looks to hit in the V. He's comfortable, right? And then once Williamson was dismissed and Latham was gone, then Phillips sort of came in. He took his time. He knew if you take the game into the 42nd, 43rd over, still 12 and over, if these both are together, they can probably try and chase it down. But then finally, Bumrah was brought back, and then by then, you know, Bumrah, even on his off day, I think he's too good in the death overs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those two or three overs where it was, Bumrah and Shami, I think, just shut it down for three overs, and suddenly the run rate went up and the pressure was so great that it made it almost impossible from there on for New Zealand.
Absolutely. And from then on, unfortunately, it became a procession. Daryl Mitchell needed some attention on the field, but very deservedly, not only did he hit 100, but he kept going. He kept trying to take New Zealand home. He waited maybe Chapman can get on, maybe Santner can hit nothing, nobody, then maybe Saudi can hit nobody in the end. And then he was out. But then what happened in the end was simply an inevitable thing, because there was so much scoreboard pressure. And I mean, you needed like a Glenn Maxwell like knock from the 37th, 30th over to take this home if you are a New Zealander. That's where I thought maybe Nisham, but I mean, maybe it would have been a bit too far for him as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's nobody who's anything like a Maxwell that's going to be there. And, you know, let's face it, Maxwell's only going to come off one in five or six times. But Mitchell's amazing. He scored over 1,200 ODI runs this year at an average of 52.
Right.
And a whole lot of test runs as well. He's just become absolutely vital to New Zealand.
Mm.
And, you know, with Williamson coming towards the end, at least he's a little younger than Williamson and slightly to carry on for a while, I'd imagine.
No, absolutely. I mean, that is there, but also probably less prone in terms of his body. Maybe he can be the next, what shall we say, the next bulwark of this batting order. Latham needs to kick on, but Latham has some, you know, he brings a lot of good things to the team. You saw how between him and Phillips, they built the innings in that game where New Zealand started. So he has his qualities, but probably this is not going to be one of the games where he would shine through. Nonetheless, you know, New Zealand have nothing to be ashamed of. They played really well. I mean,
there's no doubt that India were a better team, but New Zealand played extraordinarily well, given the fact that they don't have the same level of talent that India obviously have. So to do as well as they've done has been fantastic. That sounds very patronising, I know, but at the end of the day, I think they've got a lot of hope for the future, particularly with Ravindra coming through this tournament in a way that nobody anticipated.
Absolutely. That's the main thing. Look, Conway is a proven entity. Sometimes he sort of flags off towards a big tournament end. We know that. Williamson maybe has one or two good seasons. Latham Phillips setup, their one-day setup and our limited over setup looks very, very good. And they have been churning out good results. The last five World Cups, five semifinals and two finals, right? So, well, one day they'll win. One day they are going to win. It's just a matter of time. Not yet is unfortunate, right?
Yes. Oh, well, fingers crossed.
Absolutely. Now, from that...
Sorry, just one other thing in relation to India.
Mm-hmm.
The one bowler who I mean, I know Jadeja didn't perform particularly well in this match, but I'm prepared to forgive him for that because he's so good.
Mm.
The bowler I think is of a little concern for India is Mohammad Siraj.
Mm-hmm.
If I had my druthers, I'd actually prefer to see them pick Ashwin and Siraj for the final match, but I don't suppose they will.
All right. So I think we'll go there shortly. It'll really depend on the pitch. Ahmedabad has two sort of pitches. We've actually seen that when they did two test matches back-to-back during the corona years. I think they'll go for the harder pitch, the one which will support the faster bowling, but also which means it could be a slightly higher scoring sort of game, which is what you want, right? Given the World Cup final. So on such a pitch, I must say Siraj should be the starter ahead of Ashwin, because two spinners is all you would need. And two of India's spinners who are sort of on song, Jadeja and Yadav, are more than enough. You would want the cushion of the pacer. And Siraj has it in him to do well in big games. We've seen what he did in the Asia Cup final. I mean, you would hope that Siraj turns up, right, when it comes to the finals.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. The counter I would put to that is that I think Australia are very vulnerable to spin.
Yeah.
And if they get a reasonably fast track, I mean, no, it's not going to be really fast track at Ahmedabad, but a reasonably fast track, the pace on the ball suits Marsh and Warner and Head.
Mm-hmm.
And the key for Australia is in at least one of them going big. If none of them goes big, Australia's dead already, I think.
Absolutely.
I'd be inclined to be looking at having a spinner on by the seventh over against those guys if they're still there, because frankly, their performance against spin is highly, highly suspect. And I think you look at what Warner and Head did the other day while there was pace on, they went crazy. But once the pace goes, much, much more suspect. Sorry, we haven't talked about the second game, have we? So
now we will go there. We will go there. So it's okay. I mean, it's okay to actually do a quick preview while we are talking of these things. I don't expect any change in the Indian 11 going into the final. I mean, why would you?
Because, I don't think either team would change. Right. I think that's true.
No, that's the right thing, because otherwise, you know, you're in a bit of problem.
That's provided Shubman Gill is, it was just cramp for Gill, was it?
I just think it was the conditions and cramp, because the very fact that he came out and then also fielded for a part of the second innings, I think he's okay.
Yep. That's right? What I figured.
All right. So, well, we've had a quick chat on India's team going into the final, so that's all right. So before we get to Australia, we should probably see how they got there to the final. So again, win the toss, bat first would have been ideal for South Africa, isn't it?
Well, yeah, except. I wondered even at the time whether Australia would have been better off to choose to field if they'd won the toss because of those conditions. I mean, it was conditions we haven't seen so far in this tournament. It was heavily overcast the whole time, high humidity, and not so hot as to make it unbearable to field in, as we saw.
Right.
And, you know, that opening eight overs in particular from Australia was easily the best I've seen them bowl all tournament. Easily. Hazelwood's line and Stark's swing made it a really, really difficult batting experience for South Africa. And they came at a level that they haven't been anywhere near to in the tournament so far. Basically, this match was decided in the two first 10-over power plays on each side.
100% right. So, first of all, Australia, seeing that it was not a bad toss to lose, really, simply because they're bowling. They have two world-class test match specialists who actually came bowling as if it was a test match in the starting of the innings. And, well, Quinton de Kock, Bouma, you know they're good, but then this required something else. This only probably Quinton de Kock on his best day could have done what was required. Bouma was dismissed for a duck. Quinton de Kock just 3, but 19 for 1 in a World Cup semi-final after the first 10 overs. There's no coming back from that unless, you know, something extraordinary happens. And
19 for 2?
2 even. I'm sorry. Yes, 2.
Yes.
So, and Rasif Anderson not going anywhere. I mean, he looked completely at sea. Yeah. Eden Markram had the tools, but then he was also dismissed just after the 10 overs. So, I mean, at 22 for 3 in the 11th over, well, you've almost given over the game. It's very tough to come back from there simply because this is a semi-final. This pitch will need you to make 250 plus.
Yep.
But then a lot of credit to the way Heinrich Klassen and David Miller played. They got a little bit of a break. There was a rain delay. That meant, you know, they could go back and regroup. But then they had this discussion, where are we? 4 down for nothing. Right? And then the rain delay. And then they came back. They built up beautifully. I think Heinrich Klassen and David Miller, if Klassen had played another 5-8 overs, that could have been the difference. They could have together made it to 250. But then he was dismissed by a part-timer, Head, right? Seeing how well Zampa was tackled. Zampa had a completely off day. And that's a good thing if you're an Australian team, isn't it? You want him back firing his off days out of the way in the final.
Yes. I mean, Zampa has had a dreadful history against South Africa recently. Because they haven't let him settle into a rhythm, and he's sort of got the yips. I frankly don't have confidence that Zampa will do much against India either. I don't think he's got the guile for men who are really, really used to dealing with spin. So I'm not particularly confident of Zampa doing very well in the final. I think if Australia is going to go well, they'll do it with their pace and maybe with a little bit of luck from Head and Maxwell, to be honest. Anyhow, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself again.
All right, no worries, no worries. Look, I think Miller played the innings of his life. Given it was the condition where he had to come good, or it was, when Australia would have bundled South Africa out for 145 or 150. Right.
Yeah.
So he hung in there, because even when Klassen was dismissed, the score was only 119. Right. So from there, 150 all out is potentially possible. And Marco Jansen went right away, first bowler, to Head. Again, Head comes in, he shows his importance to the team, both with the bat and ball. He reminds everyone why he's so important to this Australian 11.
Yep.
And then Coetzee and Maharaj sort of hung in there. They had nothing going because it was a really tough bowling attack to come in. And simply for Coetzee, I think a lot of credit there. He hung in, made sure at least South Africa would get to 200, right? And then Maharaj and Miller, I mean, I expected Miller to go hammer and tongs, which he was going to uncork. He hit a six to get to his 100 and then was promptly dismissed, unfortunately. Cummins also found a bit of form. Cummins has not done anything of note this tournament. Josh Hazlewood, pitcher perfect. Mitchell Starc, again, big match player coming in at the right time. Making sure, you know, at least from the start, he now has his tail up going into the final. So, 212.
Absolutely. And I tell you what's odd about Hazlewood, too, is that, I mean, he bowled amazingly well in the power play, but overall, he still only bowled 8 overs, but took 2 for 12. Now, that's right. That's just quite extraordinary. He was, in some ways for me, he was a player of the match, you know, because without that, Australia wouldn't have had a chance.
I mean, between him and Starc, I thought they shut South Africa down to such a point. If there was no rain break at that stage, South Africa would have been bundled out under 100, I think. They were nowhere. They had nowhere to go, right? Yeah. They were in such a jam. Anyway, but coming back, what you said right at the start of this analysis, the way Head and Warner started, they killed the game off right there.
Oh, that was...
60 for no loss.
See, I was predicting at the start of the innings that Australia were vulnerable because I thought there was a good chance that Australia would be 40 for 3 by the end of the power play. Because I knew Head, Warner and Marsh would all go hell for leather. And they, on that wicket, they were likely to lose their wickets fairly quickly. The fact that they managed to get to 60 for 1 after 6 overs was quite extraordinary. And I think, you know, it's easy in retrospect, but I had wondered whether South Africa might actually use a spinner to open with on that wicket, given they'd seen how much turn there was there. Not really fast turn, but nonetheless really significant. The ball that Head bowled to get Jansen out first ball turned 5.4%. Just extraordinary. So I think that Bavuma made a mistake in keeping his pace bowlers on for as long as he did. The fifth and the sixth over between them, I think, went for something like 31 runs, maybe more. And those two overs are what made the difference in the game for me. If they'd come on, if they'd managed a wicket in the fifth over with spin, I think the shape of the game might have changed quite dramatically, really quickly then.
Good point. See, when he saw how effective Markram was, that was the turning point for me when he did not bring on Maharaj right away. The guy who's actually controlled over, 10 to 25 for South Africa in every game, every of the last 4 to 5 games, to not bring him on, I think that may have been a missed thing there. And, he thought Coetzee could probably do the trick. You know, Coetzee with his aggression. He was all right, Coetzee. But look, Australians are much happier playing Coetzee on that such a pitch than the Maharaj. I mean, 1 for 24 in 10 overs.
Yeah, particularly Travis Head. I mean, Travis Head just thrives on pace. And the thing is that even if he mishits it, if he's hitting hard, there's a good chance it'll go over the field, breaking the power play, of course, but even after the power play. And the fact that he and Smith managed to put on 45 for the third wicket made a big difference.
Between him and Smith, when Head was dismissed, they had crossed 100. The halfway point had already been reached in the chase.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That was the problem. I mean, South Africa needed one or two wickets quickly before 100. If Australia were 100 for 4, I dare say South Africa would have probably won this game.
Quite possibly.
Right? Yeah. So, it was a missed opportunity that I think he will look back on. But it's all ifs and buts.
Yes.
Given the amount of runs they had, hats off in the way they defended it. So they have to be given credit in how well they defended it. Maharaj and Shamsi completely shut the game down. You'd rarely see Smith struggle like that. Between Smith and Marlis Labuschagne, they just played a test match. Test match knock.
Well, Michael Atherton made a very good point in an article this week about the World Cup. He said, fundamentally, the teams that have done well have relied on a very strong core of test match players, because test matches, ODIs are more like test matches than they are like T20s. And absolutely, you look at that, and you know, Australia's full of test match players, so is India. I mean, obviously, they've got people like Skaya in there as well. But on the whole, the test match teams are the core of their 50-over teams, and it's working well for them.
100% right. So from that perspective, he's Mr. Atherton has it spot on. So have you. In this case, that's the way to go. You treat it like a test match between overs, I don't know, 12 and 37, but not as slow. You keep that idea where you don't give your wicket away. That's the point. Yes. And that was what it was all about. So in this case, Australia did that. And even though Maxwell failed, I think Smith carried on until Inglis came and joined him. And they sort of took Australia to a point where Australia had very less to do to win. Even at 150, if Smith had been dismissed those 25 runs, I think they would have been crucial. But then Inglis was a bit unlucky. He was bowled off a Yorker that sort of rolled back onto his stumps.
Inglis was probably one of the few Australian batsmen who got out to a really good delivery. Most of the Australian batsmen got themselves out, to be honest. Some of them took yes. very weird shots. I mean, Smith, I don't know what had come over Smith. I thought Maxwell was just horrible to watch. Why does he do that on his sixth ball, fifth ball? You know, that's just crazy stuff.
Nah, that's just Maxwell being Maxwell. But you're right. Yeah. That was crazy.
Yeah.
One big shot from Maxwell. That's what I think he was also thinking in his head. He needed one big shot, and then in the next 5 hours, the game would be done.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was not to be. Right?
Yeah.
And Shamsi was on song. And you needed to see Shamsi off, because Maharaj was just then either done or he had one or two overs in hand. But yeah, Maxwell is Maxwell, right?
Inglis very much justified his selection over Carey in terms of the way he played that spin in that match.
Yes. Took up almost 50 balls, played for more than an hour and 15 minutes. I mean, that is what you required in that stage. And well, with 25 runs or 28 runs required, you know Australian tail will do it. Stark comes. Stark again put his head down. For me, because of those runs he made, Stark is the man of the match, actually. Right? Because he put his head down. If Stark had been dismissed cheaply, let's just say, that would have been an entirely different equation. But Stark, he took out 38 balls, again played for nearly an hour. He stood there, just comfortably. Cummins looked edgy. Cummins gave a chance to even, I think, towards the end. But Stark looked absolutely solid. He's like, I'm not getting out today, right? Runs, let them come. And that's what it happened. Because Australia had, 10 overs left. They had 22 runs or 21 runs to get. But they took 7 overs getting those 21 runs. That's how good South Africa were. So it was a few missed things, a few missed chances potentially.
On the whole, really difficult chances.
Yes, yes.
I mean, that catch that Curtsy dropped off head was, well, I mean, it's hard to call it a catch. It was coming back past him so fast. That catch at slip was a really tricky one. I can't remember who it was who dropped it, went over his shoulder. And there was another one, the one behind from De Quentin de Kock was almost impossible. The one off Cummins. But yeah, the luck wasn't with South Africa in that regard, I don't think. But the person who doesn't get mentioned a lot, but this is the third time this year for Australia, he's been there to guide them through to win, is Cummins.
Yes.
It's just extraordinary. He did it at Edgbaston in the very first test match against England in the Ashes. He did it earlier this year with Maxwell when... Mm. They put on that ridiculous partnership for the eighth wicket.
Yeah.
And then he's done it here.
That was
again.
A test match innings as well. You're right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about how important these two are, I would dare say even Stark, right? They're very important cogs in the lower order for Australia, because Inglis, well, he sometimes fires, sometimes he doesn't. But then these two are the important cogs in that order.
Yep.
And he showed it again, time and again. I think Cummins has it in him. He's the right sort of a captain, because he stood up today when it was required. He came back towards the end and took South Africa's wickets in the semi-final. And then also with the bat, he did what was required more than once. So wonderful plan to have. Your man Friday or man Wednesday, whatever you want to call him. But nonetheless, think of the final now. I mean, what do we expect?
I mean, Cummins has faced 186 balls so far in this World Cup, which isn't bad for somebody coming in at number nine.
Not
the
at
final.
All.
Okay. So, logic and every sense says that India is going to win. They've got an almost flawless side. I can't think of any weak links. I mean, I know Siri Kumar Yadav hasn't made any runs, but really he hasn't been in a position to. They haven't needed him. There's got to be an extraordinary set of circumstances for Australia to win. I mean, first up, they've got to come pumped like they did for the semi-final. That was the thing we didn't mention in talking about that game was their fielding, particularly the first 10, 12 overs. Two magnificent catches from Cummins and Warner, a whole lot of boundaries saved in the covers and on the boundary that just kept the lid on South Africa really, really tight. And that sort of attitude, if they can bring that, makes a huge difference. But I can't see Australia batting first and winning in pretty well any circumstances because I think India are so good at chasing, particularly with Kohli. So the only opportunity I see for Australia to win is to actually have India bat first to hold it as tight as they can, hope to get some early wickets in the power play by bowling the way they did against South Africa, although they won't have the conditions in their favour like they have, but have a total of less than 400 to chase. And they almost certainly won't get that, but they do have the possibility. With Marsh, Warner, Head and Maxwell, they've got four players who can hit it hard and get runs fast. If a couple of those came off in a chase, you'd get there. I don't think they will. I think India are too good a team to allow them the space to be able to do that. And their bowling, their fast bowling is too well controlled, and their spin bowling will bamboozle most of those. Although, you know, particularly with Marsh and Maxwell, if they actually get in, they're much better with spin. But their first 20 or so runs, they're much more vulnerable. But I can't see past India winning this because they are head and shoulders above any other team in terms of talent, in terms of performance, and in terms of form at the moment. So I think it's a very, very outside chance of Australia winning. It's going to be fine weather. It's not going to be excessively humid. It's going to be warm, mid-30s, but not as oppressive as it has been in some games. And I think it's going to be a pitch where there will be a bit of turn, but not huge amounts, as you suggested. The highest score at Ahmedabad so far in this World Cup has only been 286. Which Australia made against England, but in all the games so far, the team chasing has won, except in the Australia and England game, and that's because England were just shit. They should have won that game chasing 286, but they didn't. So I tend to think the team chasing is better set at Ahmedabad, but India is quite capable of scoring well over 400 and making it almost impossible.
Indeed. I mean, it really goes with whether the team winning the toss will bat or bowl first. It might not be a bad bowl first sort of a scenario. Yes. Both teams have a confident bowling attack, right?
Yes.
But for me, it's about the opening matchups, I think. Sharma, Gill versus Stark, Hazelwood, or Warner and Head versus, you know, Shami and Siraj.
Yes.
Sorry, Bumrah and Siraj. So these are the real first matchups I would like to talk about where it's quite mouthwatering. You can't stay away from the starting of either innings. It's going to be fantastic. Also, I think what you already brought up, Zampa versus the Indian top order. For me, Kohli has a little bit of a, well, some say he's a little bit wary against leg break, but the ball needs to turn as well, I suppose. I mean, that old joke where Zampa doesn't turn the ball. But outside of that, Zampa has been very effective against top order batters, in as much that he's not quite shut the game down much like a Maharaj did or much like Jadeja can sometimes. But look, it's about what you can do. If he can take out one or two batters like Kohli or, you know, maybe even Rahul potentially, that could be enough for Australia to keep India. If India were to be batting first, they still get off to a flyer. That will be the one point where India will be a little bit wary.
It's true. I think I haven't done the study to establish this, but my gut feeling is that Zampa has been at his most effective when batting sides have felt under pressure to score and taking risks against him that, you know, he's had a number caught on the boundary, which isn't an indication of a bad ball necessarily. Sometimes it's really well bowled and the trap is set. But he also gets some, as most leg spinners do, with a rubbish ball from time to time. I don't think India are nearly as prone to fall to a rubbish ball. The key will be whether they're feeling under some scoring pressure when he comes on to bowl. And the history to date has been that because Rahul and Gill have done very well opening, that they've been able to take it relatively easy from, say, overs 15 to 35 without feeling the pressure of the need to score fast.
Absolutely. You have it right. So that is the one thing he may find it a bit tough. Then Maxwell and Head will need to chip in, because those middle overs, I think Maxwell did a wonderful job also against South Africa. So if you think about it, I think they might be as crucial as Zampa in the middle overs, these three spinners for Australia.
Yes, although there's a part of me that believes that Maxwell is a bit of a con job in that he gets through his overs really fast, which I think is a really good idea. And he trundles. And against South Africa, nobody took him on. Because of the state of the scoreboard, he was able to get through a lot of overs at very little expense because of that. I don't see India allowing to do that. I think they're going to challenge him in a big way to use their feet more, because the ball's not going to be turning as much as it was in that match. And I would be surprised if he gets to bowl a full 10 overs. I really would, because I think there's a very strong chance he'll be under a lot of pressure from them. Head may bowl a couple just to see what's happening, but he's also a risk. I mean, I was amazed when he took those two wickets against South Africa, because he'd been hit for two fours in the first two balls, and I thought, well, here we go. But yeah, he did well, but he's not a prospect for more than four or five overs at most, I would imagine. So it'll be interesting to see how they go. I mean, the good thing is they can always call on Marsh if they need some backup in terms of bowling. They bowled him very little this tournament, but he actually has done reasonably well in terms of taking wickets when he has bowled. He's only bowled 11 overs all up, but he's taken a couple of wickets. He has gone at 8 runs and over, but he only bowls 3 or 4 overs. That's not the end of the world.
Absolutely.
So it'll be interesting to see.
So the other way around, the Indian spinners versus the Australian middle order, Marsh down to Maxwell, maybe even Inglis. How do you see this?
That is really problematic. As I said before, Marsh is particularly vulnerable early on in an innings. Both to spin and to pace, to be honest. But I think there's a very good chance that if he's facing up to spin before he's reached 10, then he'll be dead. If he's got to 20 or more, then he has much more confidence in himself and he uses his feet much better. So I would say there's a real chance that they will seek to attack him with spin early in his innings. Although, obviously, you know, it depends what's happened in the power play and so on. Yeah, as far as Head and Warner are concerned, they'll just go hell for leather no matter what. And they'll probably fall relatively early on. But if they don't, Warner manages to stay on. He could be quite a threat to India. He's got an extraordinary record in World Cups when you look at it. and on Indian pitches. And this tournament, he's done really well. And he's scored, what, 528 runs. He's scored an average of 52. He hasn't really, well, he's got 200s, hasn't he? So that's not bad. So he's the key wicket from their point of view. But Australia can't afford for him just to get 40 or 50 and get out. They need him to really score. But again, he's a player who's much better against the spinners once he's established. The middle order, Labuschagne against spin, frankly, it's a mystery as to how he makes any runs at all. He was absolutely bamboozled against South Africa the other day. Smith's not in his top form at the moment. And if there's scoreboard pressure on, he's going to be very vulnerable. But the truth is, Jadeja in particular is such a good bowler. I can't see him not getting success if he's got scoreboard pressure on his side. And that makes a big difference to a spinner's success.
Right. Now, all of these, notwithstanding, I think it's going to be a day for champion players on both sides. Somebody who can stand up in the final occasion, the big occasion. India, indeed, are finely tuned. They have enough of these champion players, but so do Australia. And you never write Australia off when it comes to a finals, right? I mean, the way they've come back from what looked like potentially a very tricky situation, that itself will give them a lot of confidence. And as we discussed, Australia being Australia, you never write them off. So with these things in consideration, first of all, what do you see as a potential score for the final, whichever team bats first? How much will they make and will it be a successful chase or not?
I think if India bats first, they'll make at least 350 and it won't be chased down. If Australia bats first, I don't think they'll make 300 and India will chase it down. So either way, India win.
I don't see
any other likelihood.
Well, look, as an India fan, I'm more than happy if that follows.
Right? What's your prediction?
I think Australia will bat first. And India will keep them down to around 260. And then there will be a successful chase in the 44th over with about 4 wickets down.
Oh, that's nice and specific. Okay. Got you on record now.
Yeah, fair enough. It's going to go out hopefully later today. So it's going to be on record before the finals. Excellent. Right. Either way, you don't want to miss the game tomorrow. You want to be there the full time. And we wish many of our listeners also will be able to tune into Guerrilla Cricket and enjoy the occasion with us.
Absolutely.
All right. Those were all the World Cup related discussions. Now, if you were to look off field, there are already some repercussions for multiple teams. So in this case, Babar Azam has resigned from Pakistan captaincy from all formats. And he's been...
That's a relief.
Well, yeah. I agree. But he's been replaced by Afridi, Shaheen Shah Afridi, as the T20I captain and Shaan Masood as the test captain. So first, you said it's a relief. Would you like to elucidate?
I don't think Babar was a good captain. Certainly during this World Cup, his on-field leadership didn't give any indication of getting the team either G'd up or... showing any originality in terms of field placements and so on. It was very much formulaic. I didn't see it. The other thing is, I wonder if it's had an impact on his batting, because generally speaking, he was pretty disappointing in terms of his scoring. And I think let him do what he's really good at. I mean, he is a brilliant batsman, and that was not in evidence during the last 7 weeks. So I think that's good. And I think, I mean, from everything you read, you've got to take everything with a pinch of salt, but there's a sense of a lot of discontent in the Pakistan camp generally. That's nothing new. I know it's sort of predictable that if things are going to be going on off field, the teams that are going to be top of the list are going to be Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Zimbabwe, and the United States. Now France, possibly, when it comes to women's cricket.
Right.
But it's sort of nothing new, is it? I have a vested interest, I have to say, because about 4 weeks from now, Pakistan are going to be playing in the first test half an hour from me at the Optus or the Perth Stadium.
Right.
And I really, really want to see Afridi and Ruff at the top of their form.
Right.
Because it's going to be a fast, bouncy wicket, which is going to give them a really good chance of doing something that's good to watch. So I'm hoping they get their shit together. I really do.
Yeah, that's going to be quite something. But coming back to Azam, you're right. It was a bit formulaic. Well, he never looked like a natural leader on the field. And well, he's had his go.
No.
He's had his go. And one day it may come back to him, as these things can. But I'm hoping, you know, he's allowed to focus on him being the best batsman in this team and an all-format batsman, all-format winner. Let me call it like that. So this is a good thing. And I think Shaheen Shah Afridi is a potentially very positive move in limited overs cricket simply because he's done well for Lahore Qalandars in the PSL and won them two trophies back to back. And that's a good appointment. And he looks like a natural leader, by the way. Whether he has the nous and whether he'll get the backing of everyone in this team, those are things to be looked at. You're never sure sometimes with Pakistan. But that's something that's going to be very crucial. And Shaan Masood is a good appointment as well, I would say, at least, but in the stop gap, because he's never a direct pick in the Pakistan 11 in the tests. But that's not a bad pick to see if, yeah, Mohammad Rizwan lost his place in the test 11. Otherwise, he could have been the next cap of the rank when it comes to captaincy. So, but until either one of Shafiq, maybe even Imamul Haq, there are a couple of youngsters who are sort of there and thereabouts in the team who can probably become the next skipper. But until then, for the next year or two, this is not a bad appointment at all for me.
No, I think that's right. The other thing is that Afridi brings enthusiasm on the field that you can, it communicates itself. So I really like his character that, and that hopefully will come through the rest of the team as well.
Right. That's absolutely important. Wahab Riaz has been appointed the chief selector. Any surprises there for you?
Nothing surprises me in terms of Pakistan administration. I just, you know, wait till next month, might be different. Mm. You just never know, do you? I've got no idea how their system works, how intertwined it is with the government, with the military. Pakistan is a complete mystery in terms of how anything ever gets done in the cricket world, because it must be so frustrating for the players themselves to constantly see this political battle going on about them. I don't know. Maybe it'll be good. Maybe it won't. I don't know. It's hard
right.
to know.
No, it all remains to be seen. You're right. We can look at the same scenario where some other teams are also having some repercussions. Indian coach Rahul Dravid, his contract is up for renewal or not. So there have been a lot of discussions, but the Indian board has not taken any call. For the T20A series that happens following the World Cup, I think V.S. Lakshman and another set of people who are usually at the National Cricket Academy will take charge. So that's not a problem, I think. But that means BCCI have a little bit more time to decide, because I think this team has done well. I mean, they didn't start as well as most people expected, but they have grown in stature, right? And if they win the World Cup, I dare say that's the final proof BCCI will need, that if Dravid wants it, the coaching job will be his for another 2 years, I would think.
You would think so. I mean, you can't fault the results, can you? And yeah, so often if a team does badly, the coach is the one to blame. So if the team's done well, the coach should be able to take some credit, I would have thought.
Right. So I would say, yes, he's built this unit into a very, very competent unit. They have an excellent outlook even going forward in ODIs. So he's built it into the team.
Yes.
That is something really, really worth fighting. So whether he wants to keep this... job. He had stepped away from the India captaincy earlier when it was his turn, when he said it was actually eating into his peace of mind and life and so on. So he's a very clever individual who knows what he's all about. So from that perspective, it might not be a bad thing one way or the other. Maybe Lakshman is also ready if required to step into the breach if Dravid steps away. But there are some other potential non-Indian candidates who might be able to take this Indian team to the next level. But all of this remains to be seen how it goes. So something to look forward to, some small discussion points for India, but all those after the finals, surely, right?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah.
Sri Lankan Cricket Board, SLC, has been suspended because of government interference. In the short term and in the long term, I mean, things may not remain the same. We know that. But in the short term and the long term, how do you see this panning out, Messi?
Well, I think what's happened is that the existing members of the Sri Lankan Cricket Association, is it, or board, whatever it is, have been taken a preemptive strike by asking the ICC to suspend them because of the action taken by the Sri Lankan government.
Yeah.
To get rid of them. And it's an ongoing battle in the courts there, apart from anything else, and with an act of parliament being proposed around it, which seems crazy to me, but it's the way it is. I think it's a really interesting thing that when it comes to relatively minor nations in the scheme of things, the ICC is quite happy to step in and lay down the law, as it did in Zimbabwe. Mm. Previously, and I think in the US the US is different reasons. But if that sort of thing happened in a major nation, there would be absolute uproar. Mm. Because the truth is that, as you well know, Indian politics and cricket are very, very closely aligned. Mm. But they're probably a little more subtle about it in some ways, in terms of actually making sure they've got competent people in there running it. I don't know the ins and outs of what's going on in Sri Lankan cricket. And what really frustrates me about all of this is that it's the players who end up being the ones who are suffering because they have uncertainty about what's going on for them from something they have actually no involvement in whatsoever. They're just trying to do their best. Mm-hmm. And all the time, there's shit going on above which distracts from what they're there for.
Right.
So how this will resolve, I don't know, but I suspect the existing board members will probably do relatively well out of it. Whether they're any good at their jobs or not, I've got no idea, though.
Mm.
In terms of the longer-term ramifications, Sri Lanka in the T20 World Cup in June, somehow or other, a way will be found for them to compete in that, even if there is a suspension. I think you can pretty much guarantee that one way or another. You know, if Afghanistan can participate I won't go into what's going on there, then surely Sri Lanka can as well. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to follow, but I think it's almost impossible to predict.
Well, look, if you were to think of such events before, there has been government interference and Sri Lankan board has been, let's say, demoted. Previously, 2015, it happened. This time, they've been suspended. And you're right, it was a preemptive thing from the existing board, so to say. But what does it mean when it comes to their participation in the upcoming World Cup, let's just say, and any other ICC trophy? I mean, World Cup is still far enough away that things may sort themselves out in the next couple of months or in the beginning of next year, and it may not be much of a discussion point. But what happens if it doesn't?
Well, if it doesn't, then there's another place up for grabs, isn't there? Maybe they'll find one of the other qualifiers. I noticed the last qualification rounds for the two African qualifiers start next week.
Mm.
Or this week, actually, pretty well. But, you know, if there's another spot opens up because of this, so much the better. As long as they don't just cancel it, just give it to someone else on the basis of they're the best losing qualifier or something like that.
Yeah, okay. Somebody who lost in a final, for example, in the qualifiers.
Yeah.
Okay. It's going to be interesting how it goes. But quite a lot of intrigue, if one were to keep the eyes on this topic. I think we will also be discussing it in the upcoming episodes. I have no doubt on that.
Well, the one other thing you mentioned was the fallout for England.
Mm.
It's been interesting to look at the team they selected to tour the West Indies over the next few weeks. They are moving towards younger players, but it still strikes me as fairly confused.
Mm.
England have been so bad in this tournament that, you know, winning those three games doesn't redeem them in any way. That was when none of it mattered at all. Mm. and I won't go back over the stuffed selection and how they got where they are. What I would say, though, is that they won the 2019 World Cup on the basis of a very keen plan driven by Owen Morgan with support from the board and the coach in a quite ruthless manner. And I think if they're serious about the next World Cup in South Africa and Namibia and Zimbabwe, then they need to start almost at once in terms of just saying, okay, we need to look at purging. Now, yes, the T20 World Cup gets in the way a bit, but they need to sort out who they're going to have leading them, and it shouldn't be Josh Butler in a fifth. And they need then to, and this may happen sort of after the beginning of the summer in Europe, right. But they need to dedicate themselves to it in a way that they haven't done for this. They've just ridden on past glories coming up to this one, and it clearly wasn't good enough. And that's not good for cricket as a whole when they come in with a team that's just bits and bobs and looking for excuses. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting because Rob Key spoke, I thought, relatively honestly about having lost focus but that's maybe an explanation. It's not an excuse because, frankly, they've got responsibility for both. And you can do both at once. Let's face it, India and Australia are in the final of the T20 World Cup, having just contested the final of the World Test Championship. So, you know, it can be done. Somehow you've got to find that balance.
Well, shake up a little bit is good. Would they be going for an all-out shake-up in as much that appoint a new captain and everything?
I would hope so. I thought Josh Butler was a very mediocre captain right through this World Cup. And I suspect it didn't help with his performance with the bat either. No. But I don't think he performed well either on the field or with the media. And I just don't think he's cut out for the job, to be honest. I mean, just think back. He is a brilliant, brilliant batter in white ball cricket, particularly T20, of course. And I'd expect him to be captain for England going into the T20 World Cup. But once that's done, that's done. They need to move on. And you don't necessarily have to have the same T20 captain as you do ODI captain either. That's the other thing. Everybody sort of lumps white ball into the same basket, but it's not. It's so not. You look at the difference in performance of people between the two formats, and you may be looking at a totally different pool to draw on for your captain as well.
All right. I mean, if they want a new captain, who would it be?
That I don't know. I don't know enough about the depth of English cricket to be able to make that assessment. But they need someone with real vision and passion around the game and an understanding of how it works, how it is to be a leader in that space. And that's certainly something Josh Butler didn't have, in my judgment. You know, Ben Stokes has done it brilliantly at the Test level. Owen Morgan did it brilliantly. Neither of them people I particularly like, but they're brilliant captains in those circumstances. You know, it's time to find somebody else to do it in the white ball area who really brings that passion and that understanding and leadership. And it may not be part of the existing team. That's the other thing. So basically, I'm just cutting it down, not building it up, because I don't know. Sorry about that.
Well, somebody like Zach Crawley, how about I give you a name to work with?
Well, that's a maybe. I don't know enough about Zach Crawley, other than he used to have an amazing capacity to play the French cut. But, you know, he came good on the Test arena. Whether he's good enough at the ODI level, I don't know. Maybe he is. And is he a good leader? I've got no idea. None whatsoever.
Right.
You know, it's always like that. You know, I think of what happened with Australia with a vacancy for the women's captain. So they put Alyssa Healy in, who's been a great performer for Australia. But she's not a good captain. She really isn't. So what do you do? Do you you look around to see who's doing a decent job in the BBL or what. And I don't have a solution to it, but it makes such a difference having a really switched on captain in those circumstances. And it's not easy.
Very good.
May have to try some people out first. But you also need, and I don't know if Matthew Mott is this person, you need someone who's got a real passion and an understanding of the player pool and what's needed to build something. Mm-hmm. See, Matthew Mott was very successful as Australia's women's coach.
Right.
But he was also gifted with an amazingly talented group.
Come on, I mean,
who were so far ahead of everywhere else.
Meg Lanning as well, right? The leader in Meg Lanning he had was quite exemplary, yeah. I think. All right, something to look forward to. I hope they don't give it to Ben Stokes. That's all I want.
Oh, no, they won't. They won't.
All right.
Oh, God, don't start me. He should never have been in India in the first place, but never mind.
That's another story. Absolutely, right?
Indeed.
Okay. Thank you very much for your thoughts and more importantly for your participation. I know we are missing a bit of cricket, so it's the right time to talk a little bit of cricket before the big event. So thank you for making the time for me.
My pleasure, Ajit. I look forward to tomorrow's final and may we all enjoy it, whoever wins.
Absolutely. And may the best team win is all I can say.
Oh, well, in that case, India's won. Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Ajit.
I didn't want to say it in those terms, but you get it. Thanks, and looking forward to having you again sometime in the future. We wish all our listeners a good day, wherever they may be listening from. We wish to have your company in the upcoming episodes as well, as always. Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.
Podcast Network.